What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
The Pat Kenny Show
with Aviva Insurance
on News Talk.
They might say that life does not end at 40, but technically that is the case for Ross O'Carroll Kelly, who'll appear in the final ever installment of the much-loved series after 24 years, because the new and final book was released nationwide yesterday. It's called Don't Look Back in Anger, and its author Paul Hart joins me now. Paul, good morning.
Good morning, Pat.
Is this truly the end?
No, this is it.
The last book, but will there be columns?
I'm going to continue writing the column, yeah. I mean, the thing is... You know, the books take up the greater part of my year to write, you know, 7 or 8 months of the year. The column takes up a small part of my week. So it really is, for me, well, two things. It's a time thing. I want to do other things, and I want to write other kinds of books, fiction and nonfiction. I'm doing quite a bit of TV writing at the moment as well. Yeah. And I want to do more of that. And then as well as that, I kind of had a feeling for the last sort of 2 or 3 books that I was coming to the end of the story I was telling through the books that kind of rumbled on from book to book. And with I always had a cliffhanger at the end of every book. And I felt about 2 books ago, this actually feels like 24 is the right number. Yeah. I don't know if anybody wants a 25th.
Now, how did it all start?
Well, I started writing the character in 1998 in the Sunday Tribune, in January 1998. And I had been watching these school. I'd covered schools rugby as a reporter and got a solicitor's letter for my first ever report on a school's rugby match because I gave a try to the wrong kid.
Oh, my God.
And this, I didn't realise why this was such a crime. But the father of this kid was looking for an apology, a retraction and a correction, and said in the letter, you know, we're not looking for damages at this time. And so I had no idea why it was taken, you know, why it was such a serious thing.
I'm thinking back to that period, and I remember going in and out of RT and passing through Donnybrook, and there'd be matches in Donnybrook.
Yeah.
And you see these very well-heeled fellas in sheepskin coats. Do you remember the days of the sheepskin coats? And mothers of players done up to the nines.
Yeah.
All trooping up to see.
Being a senior cup mum was a sort of feather in the cap of a lot of South Dublin mums in particular. And I know a friend of mine, she became a senior cup mum despite herself because they're not a rugby family. And she was aghast when her son started playing rugby and turned out to be like the star of the school team. And she was told, you know, if they win the senior cup, you're the one who has to actually hand him the trophy. So she found herself buying all these outfits and having to go to all these social events. So it's another world. And that was the same world that I stepped into when I started covering schools rugby as a 17-year-old reporter.
Were they an alien breed to you at the time?
They were to me. I mean, I grew up in, I had no connection with rugby whatsoever growing up, you know, as a sport, as a sort of social phenomenon. So I was new to this world. And I remember being at a match and hearing a kid say to his dad, I'm not going to swear on air, but he said, I don't give a bleep how you think I played. Just crack open the wallet. He said to his father. And, you know, I kind of thought that's kind of an interesting dynamic between a son who treats his father as an ATM and a father who just adores his son.
And we thought entitlement was a Gen Z phenomenon.
No, it was definitely around.
Was there, yeah.
In certain pockets of Dublin, it was definitely there. This is the late 1980s. These characters were in my head. And I created this character called Ross O'Carroll Kelly, whose initials are Rock. Yeah. So everybody knew from the off who I was getting at. And I did this sort of, was it the diary of a school's rugby player in the Sunday Tribune? It was a tiny corner of the sports section, maybe 4 or 5 paragraphs long, pre-internet days, pre-social media. And we used to get phone calls to the office from people speculating about who's writing this. Mm. And one of the early suspects was people would ring and say, is it Draco writing that? People thought Brian O'Driscoll. I'd never heard of Brian O'Driscoll at the time, but he was doing the sports management diploma in UCD, as was Ross at the same time. And there were so many real life references in the books and the columns to the sports management course that people thought it was somebody who had to be present in UCD.
Now, capturing that sound, I mean, you mimic that South Dublin sound very well, but getting that down on paper meant that you wrote phonetically a lot of the time.
Yeah, I love writing phonetics. I love reading phonetics. I was a huge Irvine Welsh fan, and Trainspotting, I think, is one of my Desert Island books. I think I told you that before. And I loved reading the Scottish phonetics. And I think I was reading a bit of Irvine Welsh in the late 90s when I started writing Ross. And I was sort of playing with the language to see how South Dublin phonetics would look.
I mean, you'd never go to Croke Park. It would always be Croke Pork.
Croke Pork. You would never go to Croke Pork anyway.
Anyway, except when rugby moves across town time to time.
We had some fun yesterday. I was telling we did a sort of bus tour around South Dublin to say goodbye to Ross, and some fans of the books came on the bus, and I was telling them the story of when rugby... the Irish rugby team were playing at Croke Park, and South Dublin was aghast that they would have to travel to the other side of the Liffey. And the pubs in Balls Bridge put on buses so that people
they wouldn't have to drink on the north side.
They would bus them and bus them back again through the port tunnel.
Now, one of the remarkable things is that I suppose a huge fan base was actually the very people you were satirising.
Yeah, that was a huge disappointment to me from the beginning. At the beginning, Pat, I really wanted the people I was sending up to hate it. I wanted them to read it and to say, you know, I thought that's what satire was at the time. To my great disappointment, they became the audience. So all of the schools I send up, for instance, invite me every single year to come and talk to transition year kids about writing, to entertain the night study students who are studying for the Leaving Cert. I've been to all of those schools. I even gave the Blackrock College school's rugby team their pep talk before they played Clongowes one year. Now, they lost by 40 points or something, or 20 points.
It worked.
So it didn't work. that's been the big surprise. I mean, I used to be really annoyed about it, but... I think I realized in time that they recognize themselves in it. And I think that's enough, you know. Mm. The dramatist Molière said that satire is a way of mocking people while gently correcting them. And I love that.
That's a lovely quote. Yeah. Have you any evidence that people from the country used, heading for UCD, for example, used your books as a primer for South Dublin manners and mores?
Yeah, yeah. Lots of people have told me that in fact, some people have told me that they went to UCD, read my books and lost their accents within about a week of arriving. And that's happened quite a lot, actually. And when I do book signings, I meet, you know, it's one of the nice things about signing books in shops that you actually get to speak to your readership and have conversations with them. And I've met quite a few people who are married to South Dublin men or South Dublin women who aren't from South Dublin, who said that this basically was my introduction to my relationship with my husband.
At Highland, we're all about celebrating little wins and little ways to innovate digital processes. There's no customer pain point too small for us to help with. Maybe that's why more than half of the Fortune 100 looks to Highland to connect their content and data, improve processes, and turn little efficiencies into big wins for their customers and clients. Highland, intelligent content solutions for innovators everywhere at highland.com.
Oh, life.
The beginning, though, I mean, now you're massively successful, over 1 million copies of your book sold.
Yeah. Yeah.
But at the beginning, didn't look that promising.
No, I couldn't get a publisher for the first Ross book. It was a column in the Sunday Tribune, and I tried to get a publisher and couldn't get a publisher. And I was turned down by five or six publishers. And I kind of understood it. Like, their reasoning was that it was popular fiction, and the thinking at the time was that men don't buy popular fiction, and they couldn't believe that women would want to read Ross or Carol Kelly. And actually, my readership is about 50-50, men and women. But I printed the first book myself. It was The Miseducation of Ross or Carol Kelly, and it was styled on the Lauryn Hill album. And Jerry Siggins, who was the chief sub in the Sunday Tribune, and myself, we put it together over the course of about four weekends, and in a fit of optimism ordered 5,000 copies from the printers. Yeah. I had no idea what 5,000 books looked like until they arrived outside the office.
In pallets.
Five pallets, 5 foot high, 5 foot wide, either side. And I'd no idea how to get them into bookshops. So I was driving around Eason's, Dubray, Hughes and Hughes with all of these books weighing down the suspension on my, well, I was driving a Nissan Micra, my first car at the time, and I was flat to the floor. And I would go into the shops and say, look, you know, I'd explain like, well, he's kind of, Russell Carl Kelly, he's kind of a poster boy of the Celtic Tiger that we're suddenly hearing about. And he's all the things that are wrong with it. And it's a satire and I'm sending up rugby culture and I'm sending up this new culture of, you know, acquisitiveness. And they would look at me and they would say, that sounds great. Yeah, we'll take five. And yeah. And I had 5,000 of them. And so I went into a shop once, Hughes and Hughes in Stephen's Green Shopping Centre. And Liam, who was the manager there, I said to him, how's that book of mine doing? He said, that book of yours is what we call a cult classic. I said, what does that mean? He said, it means only your mother and father bought it and they haven't even read it yet. So that was kind of the beginning of it. And after about a year, 4,000 of these books were still in the Sunday Tribune offices on Baggot Street, blocking up fire stairs and all sorts of things. So I pulped them. I sent them to a pulper and got rid of them. And now... you know, I'm devastated as I tell you this, they're selling for £100 on Amazon.
For the first edition.
And I pulped 4,000 of them. And not only would I have owned all the, I could have controlled the supply onto the market. Yeah.
Keep the price up. The way that your mother helped you out, your late mother, getting you to, quote unquote, number one.
Yeah, she used to go around the shops and move my books and move my books from lower on the shelves up to the number one slot. And I think they'd only last for about an hour or two before someone in the shop noticed that isn't the number one this week and put it back. But my mother was quite resilient. She'd go back again and do it. And it's funny because I've read similar stories from other authors. They've said, yeah, my mother goes around the shops. I think it seems to be a parent's thing. Which is a great resource to have.
What was the tipping point that, you know, from this disaster of a first book to the phenomenal success? I mean, what volume was the one, do you think?
It was the late Paddy Murray, who was the editor of the Sunday Tribune at the time, said to me, we're taking the column out of sport and putting it on the back of the news section in the Tribune. And he said, because it's not about sport anymore. It's social commentary. And that was it, really. I think it got a bigger readership and it just sort of caught a wind. These things can happen. And I remember being invited out to UCD. I hadn't stepped out from behind the anonymity, the mask. Nobody knew who wrote the column. And I think that was the start of it as well, because I knew to promote the books, I had to be Paul Howard. And I went out to UCD one day. They asked me to read. And it was in the big lecture hall, the biggest lecture hall there. I think it's Theatre L. And there were so many people waiting. The fire officer closed it down. So it was kind of my, you know, where the streets have no name moment. That U2 video where they shut down the location. We are closing the location. That was kind of, and that was it. That was really the start of it being big.
Now, the books are peopled with real people a lot of the time. I mean, we're kind of a couple of years behind the curve, really, in terms of contemporary events, because Boris is still knocking around.
Yeah.
And all of that. But when you do attribute comments to real people, there's one early in the book, the current book, attributed to Jamie Heaslip, quite rude.
Yeah. Oh, you got to that bit, did you?
And I'm wondering how Jamie would react to having that attribution. Or are they delighted when they're mentioned?
Well, nobody's no one has ever complained about having a cameo in the book. Some people have actually, I won't name names, but some people have solicited for cameos in the books. But no one is, I think everybody takes it in the spirit it's intended. And like Ross's local now, since Kylie's has closed, is The Bridge in Balls Bridge. And, you know, Jamie Heaslip and Rob Kearney and the Dave Kearney and Sean O'Brien own the pub. But in the Ross books, they're actually behind the bar pulling pints. And so there's all this banter between them all the time. But it's totally imagined and it's totally ludicrous. Mm. But I mean, any interactions I've ever had with Jamie and Rob have been very positive. So people, yeah. people who get reference to the books, they tend, nobody's ever got upset so far.
Yeah, I'm just wondering how much they identify with all the behaviours and attitudes of Ross and the women and so on, or do they see it as high satire too?
I think what I've done with Ross is I've created sort of grotesques out of the South Dublin caricatures. Yeah. They're really exaggerated. It's like when you draw a caricature of somebody, you make the nose a bit bigger, the ears a bit yeah. bigger, and I've just made them, you know, far more awful than they are in real life. But only sometimes. Occasionally, something will happen in real life, and I think, God, I haven't captured that quite well enough.
I mean, he should be utterly dislikable, and yet he's not.
Yeah, and I told you before, I was a huge fan of the Flashman books, and I was reading the Flashman books at the time I started writing Ross. And
he's a cad.
And he's a cad, and he's a coward, and he's a bully, and he has no redeeming features whatsoever. But when you read the books, you're pulling for him all the time. You want him to win. You want him to get out of all these scrapes he's in. And I was fascinated by what George MacDonald Fraser did with that character to make him likable. And my conclusion was that it was his honesty, that whatever other shortcomings he had, he was always 100% honest about who he was. And I think that's what I did with Ross.
Some of the comments coming in. The early days of Ross O'Carroll Kelly brilliantly captured the time of schoolboys and girls on the Dort.
Yeah. Well, I did most of my research on the Dort, as it happens.
My sister went to college in the US in the late 90s. She brought the Ross O'Carroll Kelly books with her. Her roommate, who was American, loved them and pestered her for new editions every Christmas when she came home to bring back with her. The universal theme of the entitled jock.
Yeah, it's funny because probably the only country where I've heard, you know, that it sort of got purchased outside of Ireland is America. Now, they don't sell in shops in America, but a lot of Americans have said, they've said to me over social media that they've read the books and got them, because it is that whole schools rugby thing. It really is that sort of American high school jock thing transplanted. And I think that's why Americans get it so well.
Well, the final book, and there won't be any more.
No, there won't be. This is it.
This is it. Don't Look Back in Ongar, it's called. And Paul Howard, its creator. Paul, thank you very much.
Thanks
for
joining
us.
The Pat Kenny Show.
With Aviva Insurance.
On News Talk.